our blessing.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher bachar banu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai noten haTorah.
So we should do our learning today in the merit of a refuah shlema for Sylvia Singer, daughter of, if we don't know her mother's name, it's just Bat Zara, and she should have a refuah shlema. And welcome, your friend.
Yes, this is Barbara Siegel.
Hi, Barbara. Nice to have you. Nice to have you.
She lives welcome. Near me, so we're probably come together a lot.
Wonderful. It's good to have you.
Nice.
Okay, we'll be extra nice. So cut out all that stuff that normally happens here. We'll just try to be really nice. Okay. This is a wonderful group of people. I hope you enjoy. Mm-hmm. All right. This week's Parsha, we begin a new book of Torah. We are beginning the book of Vayikra. And the book of Vayikra begins on page 545. Thank you. 545. And we are going to read the very first sentence, the first verse, have two things to say about that, and then because we are also, the Shabbos is a special Shabbos, it is Shabbat HaChodesh, which means the Shabbos of the month, meaning the month of Nisan. As it happens, this is going to be an extra special Shabbos, because normally Shabbat HaChodesh is the Shabbos that precedes Rosh Chodesh Nisan, but in this case, Rosh Chodesh is on Shabbos, so it is Shabbat HaChodesh, it is Rosh Chodesh, and it's also the regular Parsha. So this is a very unusual occurrence that usually only happens one time a year. We're going to have three Torahs this week. Okay, so there will be the Torah for the Parsha Vayikra, there'll be a Torah for the special Rosh Chodesh reading, and there'll be the special Torah for the Maftir that'll be for Shabbat HaChodesh, of announcing the fact that we're going to beginning Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The only time this usually happens is occasionally during Hanukkah, because Hanukkah has a Rosh Chodesh in it, so occasionally you'll have a Hanukkah reading, the Parsha reading, and the special Rosh Chodesh reading all together when that falls all in one. But so it's very unusual to have three Torahs at any other time of the year other than during Hanukkah. So get ready. Hopefully your synagogues have three Torahs. What was that? Oh, you should have had two. Oh, I was saying, you're right, you had two Parshas. You had Vayakel and Pekudei, two Parshas, and then Shabbat Parah, we had the special reading. Yes, and Hallel. We also have Hallel because it's Rosh Chodesh. So it's going to be a very full, it's going to be a real Shabbos, okay? It's going to be a real Shabbos. Okay, so let's take a look at the very first verse of Parsha Vayikra. This is a new book of the Torah. And Patricia, would you like to read that first verse for us?
He called to Moses, and Hashem spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when a man among you brings an offering to Hashem from animals, from the cattle, or from the flock, shall you bring your offering.
Okay, we're going to do what the commentators do across the board, which is the very first thing we have to comment on, is to look at the Hebrew side on the very first word, which says, Vayikra, and he called El Moshe to Moshe. And what do you notice right away on that first word in the Hebrew? Even if you don't know Hebrew, what do you notice about that word? There's a very small aleph. The last letter in that word is a small aleph. And the reasons are a number of reasons, but the one that's the most famous reason given. And thank you, Kay. Are you going to shut the door for us? Thank you. The word Vayikra means, and he called. But it is a type of calling or speaking to someone that implies friendship of an equal person. Like you call your friend, you would use this word Vayikra. Normally, we have the word that when God is talking to Moshe, it says Vayidaber, and God spoke, or Vayomer, and he spoke. All of those words that talk about speaking. This idea of calling is the idea of like how I would say, I'm calling you. So Moshe, in his humility, says to God, I can't write that you're calling me like a dear friend, like I'm like an equal with you. That's like not appropriate. And God is, write Vayikra. That's what I wanted to say, because you are my friend, and I want you to write that. And Moshe's like, no, I'm not writing that. So it's out of his humility, but the paradox is, he's a humble person, but he's arguing with God. He's saying like, don't write that. No, you will write that. No, I don't want to write that. No, you will write that. So the compromise is, Okay, Moshe says, I'll write it, but I'm going to make the Aleph small. And the idea of Aleph is, first of all, it could have been any number of the letters in there could have been written small. But specifically, it's the letter Aleph. It's the letter Aleph, which is number one, that has to do also with the idea of ego. Like, I'm number one. Like, the word for I in Hebrew is ani or anochi. Both of them start with the letter Aleph, and it has to do with I, the importance of number one. And it says that Moshe diminished the I, diminishes the ego, because he has a sense of humility. He knows he's important. Clearly, he's arguing with God, and he's writing the Torah. But this idea of being small and humbling himself, so that is the idea of why that word is written small like that. It also changes the word really to, it could be read as vayikar, which also means to happen. So like in Hebrew, you can say makore, which means like what's happening, in kind of slang. Okay, what's happening? Makore, or makarapo. You could say what happened here. It implies happenstance as opposed to a endearing type of calling. God just happened upon Moshe instead of, he called them an endearment. So it changes the tone to one of not so significant, and that was Moshe's request that it be done like that. Now Moshe's humility and his greatness are always juxtaposed. And I want to just for a moment, if you just put your string here, we're going to go back to Parsha Ki Tisa, because another beautiful explanation that I had never heard before, on page 515, says that after Moshe came down from Mount Sinai with the second set of tablets after the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge, we're going to meet, not that sin, some other sin, same root. Okay, that his face was glowing, but that he didn't know. So let's take a look on page 515. Let's take a look at verse 29 there. And Barbara, would you like to read that for us?
29?
Mm-hmm.
The radiance resulted from the divine hand from which God had sheltered Moses.
Oh, thank you. That's the commentary to it. Just go right above that, above the line to the actual verse. You're at the bottom of the page. Go to the top of the page.
Oh.
On verse 29.
When Moses descended from Mount Sinai?
Uh-huh.
With the two tablets of the testimony in the hand of Moses as he descended from the mountain, Moses did not know that the skin of his face had become radiant when he had spoken to him.
Okay. So the encounter with God had made Moshe radiant. The spiritual is a lot of beautiful explanations. The two that I heard that were so beautiful, and this was from Rabbi Wallerstein, is quoting, I believe, in the Midrash, in the Gemara, said that when Moshe came down, that he didn't know that his face was radiant, that he saw the radiance reflected in other people's faces, and he thought it was they who were radiant. Because he saw other people's greatness and saw what made them radiate deep spirituality. So he didn't know it was him, he thought it was them. Because other people say, how could you not know? Like, didn't you see beams of light? But he thought that they were coming from the other people that he was speaking with. So that's how he saw the Jewish people and their greatness. So that's our goal, is to be able to see the radiance of other people in our life. Another explanation, then the question has to come, is like, so where did this light come from? So it's another beautiful connection. It says, if you go to page 507, so turn back a little bit more, there's an interesting little interlude when Moshe asks God to be able to understand and comprehend the way he works. This question is always identified as, the people want to know, why do bad things happen to good people? And God basically says, you cannot understand the answer to that question. It's beyond human intelligence. Some of what we discussed last week from Shabbat Para is, there are things beyond our comprehension. We don't get to understand that. So when Moshe asks that question, verse 18 at the top, he says, show me now your glory, meaning, show me how you work. And God says to him in verse 19, and we're going to look at verses 19 and 20. Bernice, would you like to read 19 for us?
He said, I shall make all my goodness pass before you, and I shall call out with the name of Hashem before you. I shall show favor when I choose to show favor, and I shall show mercy when I choose to show mercy.
Okay, so he's kind of answering the question a little bit. I'm going to pass it for you, and you will see something, and I'll call out with my name, Hashem, and the name Hashem is the name of mercy. So we have two names. We have the name Elohim, which is God, in the how we experience God as God of judgment, and Hashem, the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh name, is the name of mercy of Rachmanis. So it says, I'm going to call out within my name of Rachmanis, I shall show favor when I choose to show favor, and I shall show mercy when I choose to show mercy. And then he continues on in verse 20. And Rena, would you like to read verse 20?
He said, you will not be able to see my face, for no human can see my face and live, as Hashem said. Behold, there is a place near me. You may stand it on the rock.
And continue with verse 22.
When my glory passes by, I shall place you in a craft of...
A cleft, yeah, a cleft of the rock.
Of the rock. I shall shield you from my hand until I have passed.
Okay, so then, I should say, so shield you with my hand until I have passed. Then I shall remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face may not be seen. So you will see the impact of what I do, but you cannot see the reason. You cannot see the face of it. You can see the aftermath. And in fact, I'm shielding you with my hand, so bless you, so you cannot see it. So one explanation is that when God shielded Moshe with his hand, that he touched Moshe on his face, bless you, and that encounter caused the light, that encounter caused light then to radiate from Moshe's face. And so that is one explanation given of where did this light come from that Moshe radiated, because he wasn't radiating any light before, but he was radiating it then. So that we can bask in the light of God and not have answers to all our questions. That sometimes we give ourselves a prerequisite. If I can understand why God does, young children who are sick, the Holocaust, why someone has a blood disorder, why this happened, why that happened, then I can have a relationship with God. It's like, that's not how it works. We have the relationship with God, and we are in the cleft of the rock, and God's hand literally is over our eyes. We cannot see it. It is not for us to see, but we can see and be know that the relationship is there, that it exists. So that's one of the explanations given for where did this light come from. The second is also so beautiful. It says that it came from the extra ink that God had prepared for Moshe to write the Torah. And that there was extra ink, and he put the ink on God, on Moshe's face. Now, normally, if you put ink on your face, that's not such a pretty sight. But if it's the ink that was used to write the Torah, it says it was the extra ink. So then there should be a question. What's your question?
Why was
there extra ink? If you're God and you know how many letters are going to be written and you know how much ink there needs to be and you are the perfect creator, there shouldn't be extra ink. It's like, you know, sometimes when you put something together and you have extra parts at the end, and you're like, uh-oh, something went wrong because there's an extra screw, which means I probably messed up in how I put it together. So why was there extra ink? So there was extra ink because God's original intention, there were two plans. Oh, God always has plans for everything. There's many options. We have the Parsha of Tetzaveh, where Moshe's name does not appear because Moshe said to God, if you're going to not be with this people following the sin of the golden calf, then erase me from your book. Erase me from the Torah. So there was enough ink to write Moshe's name, but Moshe asked for his name to be taken out. So there was the ink from Moshe. And also we have this whole thing going back now to our Parsha, with the word Vayikra, is there was enough ink for a large olive, but Moshe only wanted a small olive. So now we have enough the ink for Moshe and a bigger olive. So that extra ink went onto Moshe's face, and he radiated. Now those two things have something in common. When Moshe said, if you are not going to be with the Jewish people and save them, because God says, you know what, let me just wipe out the Jewish people and I'll start over with you. And Moshe says, if the people aren't there, I don't want to be there either. Take me out of your book. Okay, so in fact, God does not take Moshe out of the book, out of the story, but he does fulfill Moshe's request and take his name out of one Parsha, the only Parsha that doesn't have Moshe's name since Moshe is introduced as an infant. And that is in Parsha Tetzaveh, Moshe's name does not appear. So God removes it. And the same thing with Vayikra, that Moshe is saying, diminish me. So do you see the relationship of what is happening? Is in each case, there's a request for diminishing and putting other people forward. if the Jewish people aren't going to be part of it, I don't want to have any story. Don't make me look so important and so special. Diminish the word of Vayikra. Make it something smaller. And in each case, we think like that when someone makes themselves small and diminishes their ego and makes themselves what's called an ish katan, a smaller person, that you get to be a smaller person. But the truth is, you become a more radiant person. And so the result is that this ink that was resulted from the diminishing of Moshe's self actually causes him to become greater. Just as a person who flees from honor, honor will pursue him and will overcome him. And a person who chases honor and says honor will flee from him. So Moshe, in wanting to be smaller and more diminished, he ends up actually being more radiant, so much so that he has to put a mask on his face so that the people can be in his presence because it's so overwhelming brightness. So that is just a little insight into where we get this idea of this Vayikra of Moshe. Susan.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Tetzaveh. Moshe's name does not appear in Tetzaveh.
So for the rest of his life, his face is like that?
So it says that when he was speaking Torah, he uncovered his face because lest there be any interference and people say, oh, we must have heard wrong because he had that mask on his face and we couldn't understand what he was saying. So when he taught the people Torah, he removed the mask, but for regular discourse, he was veiled. So because he was radiant and it was more than the people could really bear. So it was too much for them. Okay. Huh, I thought, that's so nice. So I never heard any of this before. I only had heard about the big Aleph, little Aleph, with him wanting to diminish himself, with the whole thing about the ink and where his radiance came from, and that trade-off when we think that there is, that we're somehow going to losing. We're losing our position. We're losing, people are going to notice us. We have to make sure that we're important and out there and out in the front and making a grand entrance. Otherwise, you know, making sure we're getting enough attention, enough honor, enough all these things to have our place. It's like, no, we actually create more of a place for ourselves by stepping back a little bit. Bernice.
I don't know. Probably most people here maybe know this, but I forget who the sculptor was, but when statue of Moses.
Oh, Michelangelo.
Michelangelo. He put horns.
Yes.
On Moshe.
That's right.
But it's because he misinterpreted the words for rays.
Right, it's Karen.
Yeah.
Karen means rays, and it also means horn. So it means both, but it certainly did not mean he had horns.
Right.
I mean, I remember, you know, with my curly dark hair, that growing up in a non-Jewish environment, people say, do you have horns under all that? Is that why Jews have curly hairs? Because they have horns under there? I'm like, no. Yeah. So, yeah. So that's too bad about that. They missed, like, the whole main idea.
It messed things up.
There was a big, yes, it caused a lot of grief for a lot of Jewish people for many centuries, that artistic mistake.
You might ask, well, why did Hashem do that?
We might ask, and we don't get to know. But maybe if we could say, do I have beams of light? If they would have said, do you have beams of light coming from you? I'd say, I do. Yes, we're the Jewish people. We have beams of light coming from us. We are a light unto the nations. It's a good opportunity to explain what that means. Instead of just saying no, I should have said what it really was. And yes, I do have beams of light. And check that out. Okay. All right. So this is the Parsha of Vayikra, and it opens up with Moshe. Now we're going to go back to page 545 because we want to talk about one other aspect here. Where it says that that Hashem spoke to him from the tent of meeting. So that God always spoke to Moshe in the tent of meeting. It said from between the kruvim, from between the cherubs, as he would speak to Moshe. And you might think that God maybe spoke, and that nobody else heard. Nobody else could hear. So you might think that God was maybe whispering to him, like, Moshe, tell the Jewish people. So it's like, no, actually, we know that God's voice was thunderous. When we sing that, we have a psalm, one of the psalms that talks about that God's voice is so loud it breaks the cedars. It fills the world with incredible sound. There's incredible noise that is being made by God's voice all the time, not just then, but all the time. So the question is, so how come nobody else heard it? So the answer is that they weren't listening for it. They were not able to listen for it. So we have the same challenge today. God is speaking to us. Someone said, well, if God would just speak to me, it's like, God is speaking to you. So it's like having their radio waves in the world and out there, but if you don't have a radio and it's not tuned to the right station, You're not going to hear anything. It can be a perfectly great broadcast, but it will not be heard unless somebody is tuned in. So the other Jewish people were not tuned in at that level, and so they could not hear God's voice, and it stopped right at the tent of meeting. So every day God's voice is calling out, and like just as we said in our blessing here, Notein HaTorah, God is giving us the Torah every single day, just as when we stood at Mount Sinai. It wasn't a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It's being given and offered to us every single day. And every single day we have the opportunity to say, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do it. We are doing it. We're going to do it. And we are listening, except that we're not. So if we're not tuned in, we won't hear anything. And then we walk around saying, I don't hear anything. But all you need is just like a, just comparably to the little box that's called a radio, of just to tune in, and then we will be able to hear loud and clear. So it says that this was Moshe's experience as he went into the tent of meeting, heard God speaking in thunderous voice, could hear it, but it was not audible to the rest of the Jewish people outside of the tent. And it may have been that they would have been overwhelmed by it anyway. In that case, it was so close. Ours is coming via the words of Torah. It says, how is God speaking to us? God speaks to us through the Torah. We speak to God through our prayer, and God speaks to us through the Torah. So here we are. So we're here we are in this room. We are listening because we are learning Torah, and that's how we hear God speaking to us. Okay. Pesach is coming. Isn't that so shocking? Okay, so when Pesach comes, we can close our Chumashim now for now, because we're going to focus on Pesach this week and next week, along with a little Parsha part, but also Pesach, just so that we can be ready. Because hopefully we're getting ready. I have to say I haven't done anything, but other people maybe have, to get ready for Pesach. It's very easy to have Pesach, make a Seder, go to a Seder, and miss the whole point. Which is really kind of sad that we could do that, but it's possible. So this, for our remaining time, we want to focus on how can we not miss the point, and how can we focus on what it is we are trying to achieve on Pesach. So the first thing we need to know is that when we say that we are supposed to sit at our Seder, and at Pesach, we are supposed to consider ourselves as if we left Egypt. And that this doesn't just mean, now this is above and beyond the fact that we are supposed to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. That is a mitzvah from the Torah. We are obligated to tell the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And if we leave it at just the retelling of that story, we have missed the opportunity, because we are supposed to relate to it from the perspective of looking at our own personal Mitzrayim. We are supposed to look at our own personal enslavement and figure out where are the narrow places in our lives where we have gotten stuck. Because the word Mitzrayim is connected to the word tsar, metzar, which means a narrow place where things are squeezed together. Okay, so where is a place of squeezing? And this place of squeezing is not the discomfort that I'm experiencing, the things that I am doing that make me that keep me from being really free. You know, every day in the morning blessings, we thank God. Blessed are you, Lord our God, ruler of the universe, Shelo Asani Aved, that you did not make me a slave. Okay, so we say that every single day. So if I'm not a slave, so why do I have to say that? Why don't I know that? I'm not a slave. The Jews were freed from Egypt thousands of years ago. Why do I have to say that every morning? So every morning I have to say that to remind myself that I still am enslaved. And even at our Seders we say, this year we are enslaved, next year may we be free. B'shana haba'ah Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem, next year in Jerusalem, the rebuilt Jerusalem. So how come we just went through that whole Seder saying that we were free, and now at the end of the Seder we say, oh, actually we're not free, and hopefully by next year we will be? It's because there are degrees of slavery, and we are all experiencing that. So the question is, what is it that makes someone a slave? How do we define our own enslavements? So one of the things about a slave is a slave is not free to answer yes or no to requests. If your master tells you to do something and you don't want to do it, or even if it's destructive or painful or whatever, you have to say yes. If they say make bricks, you have to do it. So not being able to say no to something is a form of enslavement. So we have to think in our own life, what is it that I have difficulty saying no to? And I don't mean saying, it could be saying no to your children, but I'm really thinking more of saying no to things that I let into my life that I don't say no to. And this could be things that we identify as spiritual or physical. It could be, how is it that I can't say no to the second helping of pie? How is it that I can't say no to checking my email 4,000 times a day? How is it that I can't say no to texting while I'm driving? How is it that I can't say no to shopping? How is it that I can't say no to alcohol, to drugs, whatever it is, all those things? Anybody who cannot say no to something that is not healthy for them is a slave to that thing. Even though we don't really want to call it that, that's called being a slave. It's also a slave if you can't say yes to what you want to do. How come there's something that you know you should do, that we know that we should do, that at some level we want to do, and we can't say yes to it? It's because we're a slave. So the power of being able to say yes or no is the ability to free oneself. So at the Seder, if we stay stuck in the Mitzrayim of the past and just relate the account of that liberation, but do not spend time thinking about our own enslavement, we have missed the opportunity of the Seder. We have missed the opportunity of Passover. And this is really important, to be able to say no, especially, because it's usually, saying yes is important, but not being able to say no is usually what gets us in trouble. Not being able to say yes is what keeps us from growing, but not being able to say no is usually what gets us in trouble. Susan.
How important is it to do that as a practical matter, as you say, publicly? Or do you do that internally during the course of the week?
Internally during the course of the week is good. Externally at the Seder depends who's at your Seder. Because some of the things that you could be talking about could be very private, personal, and are for your own introspection. But it's really for looking for that chametz in us that is keeping us bound up. If we can, if it's appropriate with the people who are there to talk about that. It can also talk about what may be more appropriate for a communal environment, might be talking about the freedom that we have gained during the year, of talking about something that we have learned how to say no to. Because people are probably more proud about that. Well, my problem is, I guess it's like, you know, I'm very happy that now I'm able to say no to. And think about, because we should be able to pat ourselves on the back also for what we've accomplished. Because if we can't drum up things that where we've grown and where we've accomplished, that's also not the whole picture. We have to be able to do both. What have we said yes to? What have I learned how to say yes to? Or what have I learned to say no to that really works? So someone could say, you know, we had somebody who said, you know, I stopped drinking or whatever. I'm no longer, I've been clean for whatever. I can say no to alcohol. We tend to, though, somehow feel a little bit like, oh, well, they're the alcoholics or the drug addicts or the whatever, the users or whatever they're, but I don't have anything that I'm enslaved to. It's like, enslavement can be to something simple, you know? For me, it was peanut M&Ms, right? Okay? I let go of that completely. I eat them once a month at my Hadassah study group, a controlled amount. Right, Kay? Fairly controlled.
Very controlled.
Only that day.
Counted out.
Only that day. That's what I do. And I used to have them every Monday. And you could say, well, that was controlled, but I still looked forward to it and I needed them. It's like, if you need something, if you have to have something that is beyond, like, I have to have food because I have to live, that's different. But to say, like, I have to have a cigarette, I have to have a drink, I have to have a new whatever, I have to have. Anytime you're in that mode, that thing's got you. I have to, whatever it is, it's got you, and then you're a slave. So then you're a slave. So now I feel like I've been fairly liberated from peanut M's, but not exclusively, because I know it's a temptation for me. So if there's peanut M&Ms somewhere, I make sure that I stay away from them, and I don't go like stand over them and see like how well I'm doing not having them. I mean, that would be really stupid. So I can have plain M&Ms; those don't do it for me. So everybody has their thing, and it can be something simple. But to the extent that we are enslaved to anything, is the extent to which we are still a slave, and that we're trying to let go of that. When it comes to the not saying, being able to say no, we can talk about averas, about sins, mistakes, things that we do wrong. one of the things is sometimes we do something that we regret. We do something really wrong. And we say, oh, I'm so sorry, 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 I can't believe I did that. It says, if we do not take the opportunity to go deeper and identify why we did the thing that was wrong, we will be left with a much greater likelihood of doing it again, no matter how much regret we have. So if we don't uncover the deeper emotional, psychological, whatever reasons that are behind there and really deal with that, says that's getting deep into it. So that is something to work on as we're preparing for Pesach. When we talk about the search for chametz, the search for chametz is the weirdest thing ever. We search for chametz. First of all, it's not like it's poison. It's just like bread. So that's one of the things that's challenging about looking for these areas in our life is we've gotten so used to them, they seem like they're really okay. It's like it's just bread. It's not that big of a deal. As soon as we say about the things that we've done wrong, it's not that big of a deal, then we know that we've made ourselves an excuse. People say that who have not yet realized that they are addicted to something. It's not that big of a deal. I only have a drink. You know, it's not like I'm drunk all the time. I just have a drink, da, 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 da. I just do it whenever. You know, I just go shopping, you know, da, da, da. I just do this, whatever. If I just, whatever comes after that word, I just, the rest is excuse. Okay, it's just excuse. So chametz is like that because it's not like it's pork, which you can never have. Okay, you can never have that. It's not like peanut M&Ms are treif. It's just, I was enslaved to them, so they need to be out of my environment. So whenever we have something like that, we have to uncover what is it that is making us fall into the trap. And that is the work of searching for chametz. When we search for chametz, we, first of all, we clean and we're searching, and then we get a flashlight or a candle to really go into all the crevices and look. It's like, who cleans like that? Even before you sell your home or whatever, they say you have to be cleaned thoroughly. If you saw somebody cleaning like that, you'd say, you are OCD. You are, you're not normal. Like, that's not normal. It's like, but if you're using the chametz search as an opportunity to search ourselves, then it becomes like, oh, now that's a really good idea. That's the kind of looking that we want to do, and we want to uncover how it happened that something happened. Now, sometimes things can happen, and even in the book of Vayikra, in the Sefer Vayikra, it talks about all different kinds of sins. It talks about sins that were completely accidental, things that were unintentional, and things that were intentional. Now, it seems like the things that were completely accidental, it's like, why should I have to bring an offering for that? What's the guilt on that? It was like totally accidental. It's like, well, because in every accident, there's always a something that was involved. Either was a lack of paying attention, a lack of taking it seriously. There was something that happened that needs to be addressed. And yes, you're right, it was accidental. You are totally right, it's accidental. But if you don't address that little thing that let that accident happen, then you're going to graduate to unintentional sins, and then it's going to get you in intentional sins. So it's going to grow. So better to nip it in the bud when it is accidental. So I had this happen to me. I could not believe this. Now, I'm only telling the story because this is like where I'm at. It's not any judgment or reflection on anybody else. I've been Shomer Shabbos for 17 years. Okay? 17 years. What that means is I don't drive, I don't cook, all those things that you associate with people who keep Shabbos. I tear toilet paper before Shabbos so I'm not using toilet paper, all those things. Okay, so a few weeks ago, we were invited to some friend's house for a Shabbos dinner. I went to their house to light my Shabbos candles, and then I was going, and they live very close to Dot, where I daven. Then I was going to walk over to Dot for shul. You can bring Shabbos in early, but when a woman lights candles and says the blessing, it is Shabbos, even though for a man it's not yet Shabbos, or if a woman has not yet lit her candles, it's not Shabbos for her. So I tell you, I was ready, I was calm, I lit my candles there. She had prepared candles for me. I said my blessings and my prayers, davening for my children, and they should follow the Torah, and they should grow close to God, and my grandchildren should be this. Like, I really took an opportunity to, like, really have a whole big thing. And I'm standing there, and I was kind of waiting because the woman of the house had gone to get dressed, and then she was going to light her candles. And then after she lit her candles, then I was going to walk over to Dot for services. The husband, the man of the family, it was really bad weather out. It wasn't so nice. And he said, and it wasn't Shabbos for him yet, he said, I'm driving over to Shul so that I can leave a car there for Shabbos, even though I live close, because that way I won't have to, we won't have to walk Saturday night back to the house because it's pretty yucky out. Do you want a ride? I'm like, sure, that's great. Hopped, got in his car, drove over to Dot with him, got in the park, went in the parking lot, parked the car, went into the building, went to the bathroom, and I went to wash my hands, and I started to use the cold water because you don't use hot water on Shabbos because we don't, that creates the creation of more hot water, which is cooking. We don't do that. And as I'm turning on the cold water, I'm like, oh, like, I just drove on Shabbos. I was stunned. Like, how did that happen? How did that happen? How did that happen? I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I'm like, I have nightmares. And I just told a friend of mine, I have nightmares that happens, that somebody's over at our house for Shabbos who has a car, and I'm leaning against the car, like saying goodbye to them. They say, well, why don't you come just sit in the car and we'll talk for a few minutes? I'm like, okay. Get in the car. And they say, you know what? I'm just going to run to the store to get something, so why don't you come with me? And I'm with them, like, and then pretty soon, like, I have my checkbook out and I'm running. I'm like, how did I get here? How did that happen? I'm like, how did that happen? So all during davening, I'm like, how did that happen? How did that happen? 17 years. That's never happened. And without a thought. And if I wouldn't have gone in to wash my hands, I don't even know when I would have thought of it. So then I thought my rationalizations. I'm like, okay, well, really, I wasn't driving. I was the passenger. So maybe it's kind of like a Shabbos elevator, which you can get in a Shabbos elevator if it's being operated by someone else or whatever, and you can use it. So halachically, I didn't really violate Shabbos. And it wasn't really Shabbos yet anyway because I brought Shabbos in early. Going through this whole thing. And I'm like, okay. That's the halachic explanation about why I'm not guilty. But how did that happen? How did that happen? I still haven't figured out exactly how that happened, except that sometimes when I'm not in my environment and I'm doing something different, I get flustered. I get flustered with lots of things. I can get snippy. I can get disoriented, like I forget my name. I forget my mother's name. I mean, I just get disoriented. I'm like, I need to pay attention. I need to pay attention. So then the next day on Shabbos, I said to my rabbi, something really weird happened yesterday. So I told him, he just started laughing. So I said, how did that happen? He goes, well, yeah. They're like, he didn't say, because you need to pay attention. So he gave the same thing. It's like a Shabbos elevator, the whole thing. He said, but he didn't say, that's for me to say, is you need to understand what happened and you need to fix that. Because if that happened, then something else is going to happen. And in fact, it did. We were out of town, and we had for Purim, and we had gotten Shalach Manas, and somebody, our daughter's parents, had given us Shalach Manas, and there was a dark chocolate candy, something, whatever. And so I'm popping it in my mouth in the hotel after our Fleishik dinner. And then when I get home, I look at the back of the package, like, it may have been dark chocolate, but it was dairy. Okay, so I'm like, I need to pay attention. I'm like, I need to work on this, because I need to know, as soon as I leave my house and my normal routine, that I am vulnerable to making errors that I would never make. I'm like, I teach classes on this. How did this happen? Because I wasn't paying attention. So it says, until you understand why you did what you did, it will keep happening. And there has to be a plan, and it needs to be addressed. It's not just God saying, oh, well, you didn't know, and dark chocolate, you thought it was parve, and it's not so terrible, and it really was like an hour and a half, so like if you were German, it would be okay. You know, you can make a whole thing. You can make a whole thing about how it's okay, but in the end, it's not going to help you grow because you didn't address what is the problem. That is the problem. So it says, that is the searching for the chametz. Is what is it that's in there that is leading to the problem? And it's going to be something. It's going to be a psychological thing or an emotional thing or a mental thing. It's going to be something. that needs to be addressed before we can then fix the problems. That is our goal in searching for chametz, is get to the root of what's happening. Marcia.
I just wanted to thank you for these last two examples, because when you said, you know, you can add it, you can, you know, be hooked to cigarettes, and then you said, for me, it was peanut M&Ms, and I thought, then when you said about other things, it were more, thank you for bringing it, because I know peanut M&Ms, that made me feel like,
like that's such a minor thing.
Well, let me you, that was the only thing.
Oh no, that's just the thing that I can most publicly talk about. That's just the most public thing. There's a whole lot of other things. There's only certain things that we record and put up on a website. But now y'all know. The peanut M&Ms actually was really a bigger struggle than you would think. When I was in high school, I would drive home from work, when I worked in Cherry Creek at Chandler's, and there was a Woolworths there, and the way I took out my whatever, I don't even know what I was feeling, the way I numbed out was through, I could eat a 1 pound bag of peanut M&Ms and a 1 pound bag of those nuts that have kind of like the red coating on them, kind of whatever.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And I would eat them together, and in my drive from Cherry Creek home, I could polish off 2 pounds of candy.
Oh my God.
So when I say I'm addicted to peanut M&Ms and that I was happy that I got it down to like only having it on Mondays, like a quarter cup, that was a huge accomplishment, getting it to that. But it used to be completely out of control. And I didn't do that with anything else. It was like those things just like had my number, like all my whatever receptors.
How much did you weigh eating 2 pounds of candy every day?
Oh, I was heavy. I got heavy. I got very heavy. And then I would do stupid things to diet to lose the weight. So, I mean, you do one thing. When you do one thing that is off track, it doesn't stay there. It triggers a whole bunch of other things. It's like nothing is, it's not isolated.
I just want to say that it doesn't always have negative consequences like gaining weight or something. I was very addicted to candy where, like, my desk, everybody, if they wanted candy, they just came to my office. Because I could not function unless I had bags of M&Ms and any kind of candy. But I was pencil thin. But it was harmful to my health in the long run.
Yes.
I didn't gain weight, but I did damage to my body.
Uh-huh.
So it's not always something that's very obvious. Like, you know, if I stop doing this, I'm going to lose weight.
Yeah.
It comes way down the road.
It's harder when there's not an immediate... I mean, I was lucky that I put on weight easily. Kind of. Yeah, because I had an immediate response. But the same thing is true with spiritual damage. We may think, well, I'm doing this wrong and this wrong and this wrong, but I don't see any... Nothing's happening to me. It's like, how do you know? There's so many things that could be happening that we know that now, that the cellular level, there is damage that is being done. There's damage that's being done. So we may need to uncover it. This doesn't mean become a perfect person this Pesach or else. It just means better start looking, and there's going to be something that we should be looking for. Chella.
So I'm wondering, how did you, so after when you discovered, like, oh my gosh, I did this, that, do you do teshuva?
So the teshuva is, and I gave tzedakah, and I was like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do this again. And then I had my plan, but it wasn't enough of a plan, because then it just happened with the candy in the hotel in New York. And it was a little bit of laziness, too, because, you know, we had the lights off because, oh, no, well, that's not true. Huh. No, I don't even have that excuse. The lights went off. We weren't there over Shabbos. The lights were, oh, wait, no. Were we there over Shabbos? No. No, it wasn't Shabbos. No, yes, it was. It was Shabbos. Okay. So another excuse. The lights were dim because we only had the hall light on because it was Shabbos, and I couldn't really see the heksher, even if I would have looked. But I didn't take it into the bathroom to go look and see what the heksher was. I just, like, oh, this is dark chocolate. I'm sure it's fine. I know that's not true. I always check, except when I'm out of my environment. So clearly my plan needs more work. So thank you all. For now, like, I feel like I'm Ellen Hutt, and I get disoriented. But that's not good. There's a lot of things that can happen. Okay, so I have to pay attention. So we are supposed to look, and the teshuva process, so it's interesting, it gave me new understanding. When we talk about the teshuva process, part of it is having a plan. What is your plan for it not to happen again? And the plan can't just be, well, I'm not going to do it. That's not a plan. The plan is what caused it to happen, and how am I going to set up an environment or have some sort of a strategy so that it doesn't happen again. But until I know why it happened, I can't really do anything about it. I can just say, sorry, 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 sorry. So that's nice. It's nice to acknowledge it, but until there's a plan, it's not really going anywhere. It's just going to pop up in some other form. just going to pop up. So I was very careful, like lighting my candles. Okay, not doing any. Okay, so that part I got, but I didn't address the whole issue, which was disorientation when I'm out of my normal environment and structure, that I just kind of fell apart. Okay, so that's the work to do while we're cleaning for Pesach. And it's good to do it while we're cleaning and searching for chametz, because otherwise it becomes just spring cleaning. And we're not talking about spring cleaning. We're talking about an internal search and rescue process. And that's what we're really trying to do. And if we can focus on that, it's very helpful. And again, we also don't want to say, usually those little small things are indicative of something bigger. Anytime you can say, I have to have whatever, it's like, why did I want sweets? It's like, because if I felt deprived, or if I felt, you know, the people weren't being nice to me, or if I felt like I was unappreciated, whatever. So candy and chocolate is like, that's a quick feel-good thing. It's like, so that's the issue. So how do you address that? It's not like, oh, well, go find something else, go find carrot sticks. Like, that's not the answer. The answer is, why did I want it to begin with? And why was so stuck on it? So all these things, it's like, it just looks like a crumb, but it really is the tip of an iceberg of something that's bigger and larger that may be looming in our lives that we need to address. So there's a lot of work to do. The month of Nisan isn't nearly enough time to get all of this done. Okay. And the question that we really want to ask ourselves is that we are supposed to consider ourselves great. It's like, why did a person like me, who's so great, do something like that, which is so unbecoming of me and not fitting for me? So it is both a compliment and a challenge at the same time. It's not supposed to be like, I am such a low life that I did this. It has to be, how does somebody like me, who's so great and who has done so many good things and wonderful things and has grown so much and da 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 da, all these things, how did I come to do something like this that is not in keeping with who I am? Not even who I want to be, just who I am. And so unless we have that combination of a sense of greatness, then we will be depressed when we find all the things that we're not succeeding in the way we would like to succeed. So it really needs to be a balance of both. Okay, so this is what we want to do on Pesach, is we want to walk out of our Egypt, and we need to get out. And we see that we need help. It takes divine assistance to be able to get out of these Egypts. It's not so easy. You don't just walk out. In fact, this is also beautiful. We know, according to the Midrash, that only 1/5 of the Jewish people left Egypt. 4/5, 80%, died during the plague of darkness and were buried there and did not leave. Only 1/5 left. It's like, how did that happen? So there's lots of explanations, but one is that 4/5 didn't want to leave their comfort zone, because making changes in your life is going to be uncomfortable. People would like to be like, well, yes, if I could jump off the high dive and land in a, you know, cushions or whatever, that'd be fine. But if I have to go through the air until I hit the water, it's like that feeling of that is uncomfortable. So the Jewish people had to be willing not only to leave Egypt. You think like, well, who wouldn't want to leave? Who wouldn't want to leave? Like, you're a slave. Why wouldn't you want to leave? It's like, well, it's the process of leaving. It was like, I do want to leave, but there's this part that's called the Midbar, the desert, where there was like this unknown that could be uncomfortable, unexperienced, and I don't want to be uncomfortable. If you could just beam me up straight from Egypt to the land of Israel, I could do that. I'll sign up for that. It's like, that's not how it's going to be. In fact, when the Jewish people leave Egypt, it says specifically in the Torah that God takes them the circuitous route and doesn't take them by the way of the Philistines, the Plishtim, because it was too close. Meaning too close to what? It's like they would have gotten to Israel too quickly. And that then, if the Jewish people had really gone straight from Egypt to the land of Israel, we would have ended up being slaves in the land of Israel. We would have been the same thing. And sometimes people think this. They think, oh, I'll just move to a new place, and then I will change. Or I'll get my hair cut, or diet, and then I'll change. Or I'll buy a new purse, and I'll change. Like something will happen that's going to just propel me into this new comfort zone. I do want to change. I just don't want to be uncomfortable. So Rabbi Wallerstein was talking about, and Rabbi Tversky would talk about this as well, is if somebody is an addict, and I'll use that as an example, before they can go into rehab, they first have to go to detox. It's like, you don't get to go while you are still on whatever you're on, straight to rehab. First, it's detox. It says, and detox is a scary place. says that people suffer tremendously when they're in detox physically, that somebody, especially depending on what they are addicted to, the detox can be extremely uncomfortable, painful, scary, horrible. And most people, it's like, that takes a lot of courage to get through the detox period. It says the Midbar was the detox period for the Jewish people. They had to be willing to go to through the Midbar in order to get to the land of Israel. So in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, when God says to the Jewish people, I remember how you were willing to follow me into the desert. You think, well, like, what was the big deal? They were willing to leave slavery. Who wouldn't be willing? Well, that wasn't the problem. Leaving slavery, who wouldn't want to leave? It was like, I have to be go through detox first. I have to enter that place of the unknown and experience that I don't want to do. So it's a lot of times when people don't want to change, they would rather be comfortable in something predictable and be able to go through it, but not have to suffer the detox equivalent and go through the discomfort of change. Because the discomfort of change is going to be, people don't like the fact that you changed. You're not so sure you like the fact that you're changing. There's things that go along with it. It could be more expensive. If you decide to eat kosher food, you can look longingly at the King's ads when they sell chicken for $1.99 a pound. You're like, oh, wow, that's so cheap. Okay, I'm like, but it's not for me. So it's going to be more expensive. It's going to be less convenient. It's going to be whatever. But you're trading it. You're trading it to get to the promised land. It's like, that's where you go through in order to get where you're trying to go. And that is the process of the Exodus from Egypt. And when we get to Shavuot, to the giving of Torah, even just at Mount Sinai, just even that time, those 49 days, the Jewish people couldn't even get the Torah right away. It's like, why don't you just go out of Egypt, give us the Torah, and take us the land of Israel? It's like, nope. 49 days, which was the first period of detox, since the Jewish people were in the 49th level of spiritual impurity. And then I learned this too, which I also thought was so beautiful and something to share at the end of your Seders, is we talk about the Jewish people being at the 49th level of spiritual impurity. And during the 49 days between Pesach and Shavuot, the giving of the Torah, the Jewish people ascended to the 49th level of holiness. It says, well, but do the math here. If you're the 49 levels below ground, and you go up 49 levels, where are you?
Ground level.
You're at zero. You're not at the 49th level of holiness. You're baseline. So what are you talking about? You got to this 49th level of holiness. It says, oh, that's the difference between the spiritual world and the physical world. So it's in the spiritual world, when we make the effort to go from the 49th level to the 48th level, we are rewarded with an extra level of spiritual, of sanctity, of kedusha, of holiness. So that when we hit that ground level, it's not ground level. That's the work we did, was taking ourselves to ground level. But the reward for doing that work is an one-for-one correspondence of a level of ascent of holiness. So that when we reach the 49th day, that we are going through the counting of the Omer, we're in the sphere of malchut, of kingship, of royalty. We've gone to being the princess in the mud, to being the royal people who are marrying God, basically, is what we're talking about at Shavuot. It's like, how did we get from the pits all the way up there? 49 should have just brought us to ground, to the level zero. It's like, no, we were rewarded with the 49 additional levels, each one for the effort. So lest we think like, ugh, I don't even want to do this work because it's only going to bring me back to neutral anyway. Like, so why bother? It's like, that's not. The work that we do is going to be rewarded with the extra gain that we'll have with the levels of holiness that we can reach. So that's the opportunity. We start that counting. We start that period. We start that on the second night of Pesach. The first night, it says, the first night, this is also a beautiful idea, it says the first night's like the engagement. The engagement, the couple doesn't do any work. They're just kind of looking at each other. If you ever go to an engagement party, you know, they're just looking at each other and smiling, and everyone's saying mazel tov, and it's so beautiful, and they're talking about how they met. It says, Pesach, the night of the Seder, is our engagement party with God. God saying, I chose you, you are my people. It says, that's engagement. And then after the engagement, then you start, okay, where are you going to live? How are you going to support this person? Where are you working? Where are the kids going to go to school when you have them? What's your, you know, you, and did you get order the flowers and arrange for the band? And where's the hotel? And it's like, and sometimes the kids are like, whoa, I thought we were like in love here. Like, where did like all this work come from? Says, then the work starts from the engagement until the wedding. And then anybody who's been married knows, then the work really starts after the wedding. It's like, oh, you thought that was work. Wait till the rest of the work. Says, this is how it goes. So Pesach is considered our engagement party. We're supposed to bask in God's love, and it's called a freebie. We don't start counting Sfirat HaOmer. We don't start the first night. We start the second night. It's like, okay, that's really the night. Even though outside the land of Israel, we have two nights of two seders. But in the land of Israel, the second night is already, you know, it's not Yentuf anymore. Now it's time to work. Now we're starting the count, and we're going to Shavuot. We're going to the wedding. Now the work starts. It says, but the Pesach night is like, bask in the love. God chose us. He saw us like the princess in the mud, 49 levels down, and says, I want to marry you. It's like, you do? It's like, wow. Clean you up, dust you off. And after the engagement party, then we'll start the work to make you worthy for to be able to stand at the chuppah with me, God, as the king, and you are the queen, the Jewish people. And then the marriage can take place, and then we'll start the process of being a mamlechet kohanim, a nation of a kingdom of priests as we serve with God. So God willing, we can take these opportunities for Pesach for our own Mitzrayim. Where are we stuck in the Mitzar? Where is that narrow place? What have we? Where are we acting as if we were slaves, even though every day we say, thank you, God, that I am not a slave? So if I'm not a slave, then I have to ask my question, why am I acting like a slave? What am I enslaved to? How is it damaging me? Why can't I say no, primarily? Also, where are places that I need to say yes that I haven't been able to say yes, but more so in the no's, because those get us more in trouble? And identifying the cause, the root cause, not just being sorry, 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 that's very nice, but it has to go beyond sorry, looking for the root reason, to really search the nooks and crannies, to find that chametz that is lurking there, never know where you're going to find it, and to feel like, how can I, someone as great as me, have done something like that, which is so unfitting? The beautiful expression I heard someone say is, you're here and that's there. How did that happen? And to be able to figure out what that is. And that's how we come out of Mitzrayim. We can share at the Seder, and we can also share stories about other people. Sometimes it's helpful to share stories about great people who have overcome great odds, who have really transformed their lives, who do great things to inspire us. It's supposed to be a night of inspiration. And hopefully we can find that ourselves and know that God is going to then, has embraced us in engagement, and that we'll be working towards the marriage as we move and count the days to Shavuot. Have a wonderful Shabbat HaChodesh, Shabbat Rosh Chodesh, Parsha Vayikra, and God willing, all of our faces will glow. The Jews do not have horns, but we do have rays of light. We are a light unto the nations. We should illuminate the world that certainly could use it. All right, I'll see you next week. Thank you so much.